It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered! Oh!
You like fighting a woman?
You got grown-ass wrestlers in the back going on Twitter.
Come over here and fight me.
Oh my God, we're only an hour in.
You have legs.
They've made Solo a monster.
I was 99% positive it was just chest up.
No.
I want out of my contract if I don't get what I want.
Busy weekend in Japan. We had two all-time greats colliding for the first time ever for Pro Wrestling Noah, AJ Styles, back in Japan for the first time in about 5 years, beating Naomichi Marufuji in a great match. I saw the highlights. Can't wait to see the entire thing. On that same show, they announced the A Block and B Block competitors in their N1 Victory Tournament, which is similar to the G1. And each block this year includes one star from NXT. Josh Briggs in the A block and Tavion Heights in the B block, who recently joined the No Quarter Catch crew. At the same time that show was taking place, Marigold held its Summer Destiny event at Sumo Hall, and Io Sky made her return to Japan with a win over Utami Hayashishita. Again, I only saw the highlights, but what I saw looked great. You know, when Io wrestles in Japan, she just adds a little bit more than what we see from her in WWE. It's like she's holding back on us. You think Rossi Ogawa was holding his breath during that Money in the Bank match last weekend? I thought somebody was going to die watching that. He's probably sitting there thinking, please, please let Io make it out of the match of One Piece so I don't lose my co-main event. That's what I'm going to be thinking when Swerve Strickland works that Blood and Guts match on Dynamite next week. He's in our main event at the House of Glory show 48 hours later. Now, I said Io's match was the co-main event. That's because Julia returned to action from her broken wrist in the main event, losing to former NXT star Saray to crown the first ever Marigold World Champion. I think that might have been Julia's final match before coming to NXT. They've got their Great American Bash show coming up in a few weeks, and then No Mercy on September 1st. She's either showing up at No Mercy or having her first match at No Mercy against Roxanne Perez. And we will be seated when she finally arrives. And she's not the only arrival to talk about this week. This is episode 870. Of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, July 14th, 2024. We passed 81,000 subscribers on YouTube this week, so thank you for that. And thank you to those who have supported, including my PayPal producers. You could always make a donation if you so choose. On thesolomonster.com, I want to say thank you to Big B, Bryant Becerra, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Iowan Corn Farmer, Jesse Lamphere, Daredevil Doug Lippert, the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton, Ms. Madness Michelle Mills, Night Stalker Naif Alsafar, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Road Warrior Roderick Welch, Fight 'Em All David Fields, Best in the Game Trey Porter, and Killshot Keith Hart. And again, if you would like to support the show and make a donation, we are always welcoming rookies to the roster here. So you hear these legends, their names are mentioned every single week, but we are certainly always willing to bring some people up from NXT. So you can go to thesolomonster.com and find the link there at the top of the page. I mentioned the House of Glory show before. High Intensity. It's our biggest show of the summer. It's coming up on Friday, July 26th. At the NYC Arena in Jamaica, Queens, with the return of Swerve Strickland and Prince Nana. And this time, they are bringing the AEW World Championship with them. Swerve is going to be taking on Amazing Red. Mike Santana defends his HOG World Heavyweight title against the debuting Zilla Fatu. The bloodline will never end. It just gets bigger. So you can get your tickets now at hogwrestling.net or stream the show live on Triller TV, and you can listen to my dulcet tones, which will sound a lot better than I do now when I'm not sick. And just announced, we are making our Chicago debut Thursday, September 5th at Logan Square Auditorium. That's two nights before AEW comes to Chicago for All Out. Tickets are on sale for that one as well. I hope I get to see some of you there in Chi-Town. Last week, I talked about John Cena retiring from WWE next year. He came out last weekend of Money in the Bank and made the announcement that 2025 is going to be his final year in the ring. And I threw out some ideas and some names of potential opponents for him before he wraps up. One name that I mentioned was CM Punk. And I said that I would book one last John Cena CM Punk match to headline the first Raw on Netflix in January. I didn't get into all of the specifics of what I would do for Cena that year, which I did on Tuesday Night Titan. So I wanted to mention it here too and just expand on it a little bit more because it is a topic of conversation. People are trying to fantasy book the final year of John Cena. Now, there's been some debate about whether Cena really is the greatest of all time. That's the tagline that WWE has given him. They've been marketing him that way for now a number of years. That was a Vince McMahon thing. And that's really all it is. It's a way for them to market him. Everybody is going to have a different answer as to the question, you know, is he the GOAT? Cena himself has said that he thinks Roman Reigns is the greatest of all time. I do not believe Roman Reigns is the greatest of all time. Will Roman Reigns be the greatest of all time? I don't know. He's not done yet. I can't say. I love Bret Hart, but, you know, Bret's my GOAT in terms of matches, but he didn't do the kind of business that the all-time greats did. So by those metrics, he wouldn't be the GOAT. Neither would Shawn Michaels, unless you're just looking at pure talent. You know, if that's your primary metric, that opens the conversation up, I mean, to a lot of people like Bret and Shawn and Kurt Angle. You could expand that out beyond just WWE. And you've got Ric Flair and Terry Funk and a bunch of others. But the two most important figures, talent-wise, in WWE in the last 40 years are Hulk Hogan and Stone Cold Steve Austin. Rock would be up there right behind them. Cena had the longevity over all of them, so did The Undertaker. But I can't put them ahead of Hogan and Austin. I just can't. I can't put Undertaker ahead of them. I can't put Cena ahead of them. Were it not for those two exploding in popularity when they did and getting pushed when they did, there may not be a WWE right now. And if there was, it would not be nearly as big as it is, making billions of dollars every single year. That does not take away from the success that John Cena has had. You could say that Vince McMahon relied too heavily on him for too long, you know, at the expense of creating new stars on his level. That's absolutely true. That is absolutely a valid argument to make. But where would they have been without John Cena? Probably not in a good place. That's exactly why he, being Vince, relied on Cena as his top guy for so long. You know, that and Cena went along with whatever they wanted him to do. You know, he wasn't known to be a pest. He wasn't known to be a pain in the ass and always arguing decisions and saying no. He wasn't known to be a politician like you hear stories about certain guys. Now, I'm not saying he never did politic. I mean, the JTG story is a classic about him using the words loyalty and respect in an interview once with the WWE magazine and instantly realizing, oh shit, that probably wasn't a good idea. Yeah, and JTG is begging the editor, please leave that part out. So I think he may have been talking about his partner. He may have been talking about Shad. You know, loyalty and respect was part of what Cena was calling himself at the time. So he's begging the editor, please leave that part out. And they said, oh yeah, sure, we'll leave that out. And of course they published it anyway. And so this was around the time JTG was about to finally get his own shades on WWE Shop. And it was his first real piece of merch. And he was a big Bret Hart fan growing up, so he wanted to have glasses like Bret did. And he claims in his book that one day Cena corners him in the men's room and says, hey, you know those new shades that you had coming out? Yeah. Not anymore. Now we're even. Now we're even, Steven. And JTG never did get those shades made. But I remember hearing that for the first time, and I'm like, what kind of maniac reacts that way? Yeah, but for every story like that, you've got a story like Tyrus, you know, talking about how when he was at WrestleMania 28 and it looked like his match was about to be cut for time, this was in Miami, that was the night Cena wrestled Rock for the first time, right? Once in a lifetime, which turned out to be twice in a lifetime. So, huge main event coming up. Cena's at Gorilla, and Funkasaurus is at Gorilla, and Cena is hearing this, and he leans over and he tells him, he goes, you know, I've got to go to the bathroom. What do you think? 6 minutes? 8 minutes? And Tyrus picked up on what he was doing. He's like, yeah, 6 minutes ought to be good. And Cena disappeared. They couldn't find him. If you can't find him, you can't go to the next match. Right? I mean, he's about to go out there for this big main event, and nobody could find him. So what they did was they sent the Funkasaurus out there to do a dancing bit on stage. So at least he was able to get his WrestleMania moment. So there's a lot of like stories like that, mostly good stories, but there's some weird ones too. Cena's just he's a weird guy. But Cena was a draw for them last year when he came back for a couple of months during the Hollywood writer's strike. And this retirement tour is going to do big business for them. It's actually genius on WWE's part, because every single show that John Cena is going to be on, and he's claimed that, you know, he's going to be doing anywhere from 30 to 40 dates, you know, TV and PLEs and live events, not every live event, but, you know, enough of them where you can get 40 dates out of this guy. You know, he hasn't been full-time or even part-time in many, many years. You know, he's got a full-fledged career for himself in TV and movies right now. So it's a big thing for WWE to get Cena back for an entire year like that. Every single show that he is on is going to be a sellout or a near sellout. Yeah, you wonder how much longer could this hot streak that WWE is on continue for? Because they're packing in the buildings and they're selling out. Maybe not every week, but a lot of weeks. Now you add the added, you know, attraction of John Cena. This is his final match in Chicago. This is his final match in New York. This is his final match everywhere. It's going to be his final match. Last time to come see John Cena live in the ring. You don't think they're going to sell those shows out? Of course they are. WrestleMania in Las Vegas was going to be huge anyway, but now they can promote the fact that John Cena is going to be working his last ever WrestleMania match. Every PLE match that he does is going to be his last ever. Last Royal Rumble, last Elimination Chamber. So the question is, what story or stories do you tell with him? John Cena has not won a televised singles match since Super Showdown in 2018 against Triple H. That means coming into 2025, when he comes back in January and we see him, he will be on a losing streak of 7 years. In singles matches. You can break a mirror and have bad luck for that long, and it ends. And that's how long John Cena has gone winless by the time he comes back in singles matches. 7 years. I would not have him come back and just win in his first match back. You instantly kill the story of Cena trying to shake off the bad luck and get back in the win column. Why would you do that? You know, John Cena versus CM Punk, if you do that on the first Raw on Netflix, like I've suggested, Punk should win. Keep the losing streak going. You know, he enters the Royal Rumble with the idea that he's going to try to win the Royal Rumble one more time. He's already won it twice. And he's going to try to kickstart his path to title number 17, which is the other story they need to tell with him. It's the chase for 17. Try to set the all-time WWE record. Nobody has ever won more world titles in this company than John Cena already. Won 16 of them. But because of the whole Ric Flair thing, you know, 17 would trump Flair and would set the record. So I would have him in the Royal Rumble match, and he should fail. So then he has to qualify for the Elimination Chamber, and guess what? He loses there too. And then we get to WrestleMania. Now, we already know it's going to be his last WrestleMania, but he says, let's say, you know, going into it, if I can't win a WrestleMania, I know I've been on this horrible, just bad luck streak. I don't know if I've got it anymore. If I can't win a WrestleMania, I don't deserve to be here anymore. I don't deserve to have this retirement tour for the rest of the year. So if I lose at WrestleMania, then WrestleMania will be my final match. The retirement tour ends early. And then at WrestleMania, he finally wins. And that is when the real chase for 17 begins. And he starts stringing together some big wins against people like AJ Styles, who I would love to see him back in the ring with, Cena and Sheamus one more time, Cena and Logan Paul for the first time. I'd love to see him work with guys like Chad Gable and Dominic Mysterio and Bron Breakker, until eventually he runs into the world heavyweight champion, Gunther. Yeah, before The Rock started calling himself the final boss, Gunther was the real final boss. That's his chance to win number 17, and he falls short. I don't think he needs to win the championship, and I know some people are going to hard disagree with me on that. I don't think he needs to win the title. Then the question after that becomes, who's his final opponent going to be? If he's going all the way to December, who is his final opponent? I think Cena against Randy Orton could be the WrestleMania match. You know, for all the matches they've had, they've never had that singles match at WrestleMania. But I would not be opposed to saving Orton for the end of the year as his final opponent. You know, as part of this new media rights deal with NBCU for SmackDown, because SmackDown's coming back to USA in a few months. Thank God. The fuck away from Fox. But as part of that deal, don't forget, they're obligated to 4 annual primetime specials on NBC. They can build an entire network special around John Cena's last stand, the end of an era. They usually run Madison Square Garden for a house show the day after Christmas pretty much every year, as far back as I can remember, many, many years. The day after Christmas is a Friday next year, so maybe they bump it to Saturday and they run the Garden that weekend. MSG would be a big stage for him to close out his career. One last match, Madison Square Garden. But that's kind of the general sense of how I would book John Cena's final year. I think you have to tell those two stories. First, ending the losing streak, and then once he does, stringing together a bunch of wins to put him in position to challenge for one last world title. And you don't have to blow off the title chase story for WrestleMania. That's the other question. A lot of people are going to say, well, how do you not have him challenge for number 17 and maybe win it at WrestleMania? It's WrestleMania, right? That's the biggest WrestleMania match you could do with him. Well, I don't like it because he still has another, 9 months left to go after that? Are you really going to put the title on him, one of the titles, and have him hold it for several months? You could, I suppose, but that's not what I would do. So if you blow the story off of WrestleMania and he doesn't win the title, and you've blown off really now the last big story that you can do. And now, you know, you've got his last match in every city and everything. It's not like, it's going to do bad business. But why blow that story off so quickly? Why blow two really good stories for him off in the first 3 or 4 months of the year? You got another 9 months to go. Save that for later in the year. Why not SummerSlam? Now, they have not announced the location yet, interestingly, for SummerSlam in 2025. We already know where SummerSlam is coming in 2026. It's coming to Minneapolis. Probably going to come to Indianapolis in 2027. Two nights. We don't know yet where it's going to be next year. Here's a suggestion for you. How about Gillette Stadium, home of the New England Patriots? Right, seen as a Massachusetts guy. Wes Newberry. Do it just before the NFL preseason begins. It could be a homecoming for John Cena. Cena versus Gunther in Foxborough for the World Heavyweight Championship. So as I say that, when you really think about it, it's like, man, they do that. If they do that, if they build throughout the entire year into the summer for Cena, right, back to his winning ways, trying to get number 17. He goes to the main event of SummerSlam at Gillette Stadium against the real final boss, right? Against Gunther, world heavyweight title. Man, it's hard not to see him win number 17 there. It would almost be too good to pass up. Even I would have to seriously consider giving him the win there because, you know, it's all about those moments. It's like the Bryan Danielson thing in AEW. He won the Owen. He's getting the championship match at Wembley Stadium. I don't think he needs to beat Swerve, but if he does, I wouldn't hate it. How could I ever hate on Bryan Danielson? He's one of the greatest of all time. He gets one last big moment. I'm sure the fans would love it, but it doesn't have to happen. You know, Bryan Danielson's legacy and his Hall of Fame status is already cemented, whether or not he wins the world title in AEW. John Cena's legacy and Hall of Fame status is already cemented, whether he retires with 16 world titles or 17 world titles. You know, all you're doing is padding their resume. The number of titles doesn't matter. It's about those moments that you create for people. You know, a lot of times we look at these stats and we analyze them like it's a real sport, but it's not. It's entertainment. How many championships you win doesn't matter because you're not actually winning anything. And I think we lose sight of that sometimes, myself included. It's about the story that you're trying to tell. And if they tell the story just right, and it makes sense for John Cena to win number 17, then he'll win number 17. Sometimes the real story is in the chase, and it can be better when you fall just short. Where Cena's story ends up depends on how WWE chooses to tell it.
Hey, it's Chris Van Vliet. Thank you for letting me pop in here for just a second. After this episode is done, go check out my podcast, Insight with Chris Van Vliet. All of the interviews that you may have seen on YouTube are also available in audio form. We have two new guests every week, and some recent episodes include a two-hour interview with The Undertaker, also Booker T, Adam Copeland, Rey Mysterio, Christian Cage, Joe Hendry, Mark Henry, and many more. Cody Rhodes is also going to be a guest in just a few days. Listen to Insight with Chris Van Vliet on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the top stories this week, after a great showing against Mercedes Moné at Forbidden Door in a match where, per PW Insider, Mercedes came into it with the idea, with the goal of making her opponent. Stephanie Vaquer should send a bottle of rosé to Ms. Moné because she has left CMLL and New Japan Pro Wrestling and signed with WWE. Yeah, I swear I've heard at least three different pronunciations of this woman's name. The one time I'm rooting for WWE to actually change someone's name, and Meltzer says that she's keeping it, but we'll stick with Vaquer. If I'm wrong, I apologize, but she walked out there against Mercedes with three belts, and now she has none. CMLL said that Vaquer had left both the promotion and New Japan as well, effective immediately, and would not be participating in her scheduled match at Fantasticamania in San Jose last night. She is said to have received offers from both WWE and AEW coming off the Forbidden Door match with Moné. She wrestled Tessa Blanchard on Tuesday and won the match. And it was pretty clear from her body language and her embrace of Tessa when the match was over, and just the way that she was acting, that she knew this was going to be it for her. And Tessa seemed to know it also. But that means, you know, with her winning, that she left the promotion without dropping her CMLL Women's World title or Women's Tag Team title that she held with Xeoxys. So they stripped her, and they held a triple threat match last night with Luvia representing CMLL, Viva Van representing New Japan, and Willow Nightingale sent in to represent AEW. And Willow Nightingale became the first U.S.-born champion in the history of the CMLL title last night. You know, over the past year, she's held the New Japan Strong Women's title. She won the Owen Hart Cup last year. She won the TBS title. And now she has won the CMLL Women's title. Not bad. Not bad for Willow. Vaquer was said to have had offers from WWE and AEW, but never seriously considered the AEW offer. She grew up in Chile. She's not Mexican. I mean, I've seen people calling her Mexican. She's not Mexican. She's Chilean. She grew up watching WWE, and her goal was always, apparently, to work there. That was her dream. She even had a tryout match with them in 2018, but they weren't interested in her at the time. Had she taken the AEW deal, she would have still been allowed to work dates for CMLL in New Japan. who, of course, are partners now with AEW, and also whatever other international bookings that she may have had, like the Rev Pro anniversary show in London next month that she was advertised for. She was advertised for the Fantasticomania pay-per-view last night, 3 months ahead of time. So they were not happy about her pulling out 5 days before the show. Now, WWE, of course, doesn't care. They want what they want. They don't much care about how it affects other promotions, although they did allow Carl Anderson to drop his never open weight title at the Tokyo Dome after he and Luke Gallows came back to the company, but that was something that Anderson insisted on before he signed. He wanted to do business the right way. He didn't want to, you know, disrespect Ghetto in New Japan, and so he was able to work that out and go back and drop the belt. In this case, there was a good reason for WWE not wanting her on the Fantasticomania show yesterday, because they wanted her on their show. While Willow was winning the CMLL women's title in San Jose, Stephanie Vaquer made her WWE debut last night in Mexico City with a win over Isla Dawn. She already made her debut, and she'll be appearing tonight at their event in Monterrey. They wanted that deal done so they could debut her on their Mexican tour. That's why she didn't drop her titles and do business on her way out. It sounds like this all came together very quickly. I see this woman taking shit from a lot of people online who have no idea what they're talking about. And they were popping off before she was even announced for those WWE shows this weekend. How could she? How unprofessional? Even after that. They may still think that it was unprofessional of her not to first drop her titles before leaving and do business. I can understand CMLL being upset, but if they or anyone else, when I say they, I mean these people online, if they or anybody else wants to be upset, first of all, unless you are a CMLL fan who really liked watching her in CMLL, it's just fucking weird for any fan to be bothered by where this woman chooses to work. And I know that part of it is the tribalism thing, because she was on an AEW pay-per-view, and there were a lot of AEW fans who commented at the time they thought she looked better in that match than Mercedes. They were very impressed by Stephanie. Maybe they hadn't even seen her work before, and they were hoping that they would get to see more of her, or maybe she would sign with AEW. And so now I'm sure many of them are very upset. The normal ones, of course, are not going to have an issue with it. They're going to be like, oh, okay, I'm happy for her. But the psychotic ones, the psychotically obsessed ones, of course, are going to be freaking out because they think it's some kind of betrayal of some kind that she was on the AEW show and now she's working for the enemy. You know, she's working for WWE. It's just fucking weird. She can't be in two places at once. She could only work one show last night. This was the deal that was presented to her. She moved to Mexico when she was 16 years old to become a professional wrestler. She tried out with WWE once before. She didn't get it. So she improved, and she got better, and she made a name for herself. She got over big on that pay-per-view 2 weeks ago. They probably saw that, and they hit her with a great offer. Or if Tony Khan made her an offer, maybe she got word to WWE that, hey, I got this great offer over here. Just wanted to see if there might be any interest from you guys before I commit to this deal. And they said, wait, hold up. Don't sign anything. Let's work something out. We don't know who hit up who first. Probably the former. But it doesn't matter. She took the offer that was presented to her. How can anybody fault her for that? I don't understand why she is catching shit, frankly, from anybody. Apparently, she had a longer-term deal with CMLL. They have let people out of their deals early in the past when they get a big offer to go to WWE or AEW, so having a long-term CMLL contract doesn't necessarily mean you're locked in for the duration. Probably anywhere but AAA, they would let you go. But they do so with the understanding that they being the wrestler who wants to leave, will do business on the way out. So if they're a champion, they'll drop their title or they'll, you know, let them book them in some kind of send-off match so they can get a big, you know, house out of it. That didn't happen here. She just up and left. Yes, because WWE felt they needed her now for this weekend. It's not like WWE gives a shit. They could not care less. They have no relationship with CMLL. They have no relationship with New Japan. Could she have asked to be allowed to drop her titles first before joining? Who's to say she didn't? Maybe she did, and they said, no, we would ordinarily let you, but we can't do that. We need you for this weekend. Like, we don't know that. And even if she didn't, who cares? So what? She's an independent contractor. She can do what she wants. Now, if she took the CMLL women's title to NXT and dropped it in the garbage can, that would be a different story. But otherwise, I just think this is all silliness. But AEW has proven to be a nice recruitment tool for WWE, haven't they? They suddenly took a great interest in Dragon Lee after his appearances on Dynamite 2. Now, I'm not saying he wasn't already on their radar, or somebody didn't already recommend him. I think it might have been Andrade who recommended him, but, you know, or that she wasn't on their radar either. But boy, you know, it took all of 2 weeks after she showed up on that pay-per-view to lock her down. You know, it's not like she hasn't been killing it for at least a year now down in Mexico, right? Why did it take this long? She's been the top female star down there for a while now. But now she's going to have the biggest possible platform to showcase her talents, and I think she's going to do very well. That's a big pickup for WWE. Shawn Michaels already posted a tweet welcoming her to Orlando, so it looks like when she starts full-time, it's going to be with NXT. NXT is also where Julia is going to be starting soon. Poor Roxanne. Poor Roxy. If Julia doesn't make mincemeat out of her, then Stephanie will. But boy, you know, you look at the talent that WWE has right now and that they have been recruiting. You had Julia on her way in. Stephanie Vaquer on her way in. Jordynne Grace is undoubtedly going to end up there early next year when her TNA contract expires. Not a doubt in my mind. There's been a lot of chatter about Delta, which is not just some shitty airline. She's an independent wrestler. I didn't know too much about her myself, but she's an indie wrestler out of Australia. She's been wrestling for Riot City Wrestling, which is the same promotion where Rhea Ripley made her name before signing with WWE. WWE held tryouts in Australia when they were down there for Elimination Chamber earlier this year. And the belief, this is not confirmed, but the belief is that she signed already with NXT and that they're just holding off on the announcement until they unveil their next class of PC recruits. Now, I've seen some of her work. She's really good. So you've got those names. Plus, you've got Rhea, you've got Bianca, Io Sky, Bayley, Charlotte Flair is going to be back soon. Becky Lynch is eventually going to be back. Tiffany Stratton is going to be a huge star. Asuka is out hurt, but she'll be back. Jade Cargill is still a work in progress, but she's going to be a megastar regardless. Then in NXT, you've got Roxanne, and you've got Lola Vice, and you've got Sol Ruka. I mean, they are stacked when it comes to their women's division. So is AEW, by the way. They've got Toni Storm and Mariah May and Mercedes Moné. They just got Britt Baker back. Jamie Hayter will be back eventually. They've got Athena toiling away in Ring of Honor, but they've got her under contract. Chris Statlander, Willow Nightingale, Hikaru Shida, Thunder Rosa. Yeah, that's not even all of them. This is the best that the women's scene has looked ever, ever in the history of women's wrestling in the U.S. I'm talking domestically, okay? I'm not talking Japan and All Japan women in the early 90s and Stardom and all that, because that's you factor them in there. And you've got a competition there. But I'm talking domestically in this country. The women's scene has never been better and more stocked with talent than it is right now. And to that end, there is a story going around that WWE is considering creating two women's mid-card titles, a women's intercontinental title and a women's U.S. title. Chelsea Green even commented on the Masked Man show and admitted that she doesn't know anything past what's being rumored online. That's all it is right now is a rumor, but she is hoping and praying that it's true. She said that they have so much talent, not everybody is able to be showcased all the time. So for that mid-level girl, who maybe the fans don't see as someone who can lead a division, adding another title could be a way to help elevate them. I tell you what, you know, as they continue to add more talent, it becomes harder to argue against having at least one secondary title. And I'm usually against adding more championships because I just think they have enough as it is. And the women's tag team titles haven't elevated anybody. You know, they're just used as a story device when it's convenient and not a very good one. But with all the talent they have right now and that they have in the pipeline coming in, I'd be fine with them adding a women's intercontinental title as a test on the Raw brand. I don't think we need two at the same time. I think you start with one and you see how things go before adding another one. You know, the minute they announced that they were adding a women's North American title in NXT, I knew it was only a matter of when and not if they did something similar on the main roster. Once she wins the title back from Liv Morgan, Rhea Ripley is going to have that women's world title on lockdown on Monday nights. I look at that Raw roster, for example, and someone like Kiana James, who got called up in the draft. She's had exactly two matches and a grand total of 10 minutes of ring time since debuting, since being called up. Someone like her could benefit from something like a women's intercontinental title. Someone like Zoe Stark. Zoe is not winning any world titles anytime soon, but Zoe getting an IC title run instead of just doing tags because they have nothing better for her to do could benefit her. And don't laugh. Even someone like Maxine Dupree. Maxine's gotten a little bit better than she was when they first put her on TV, just a little. She's learning, but she's also not getting a ton of ring time. They made her into such a sympathetic character in this Alpha Academy story. If she continues to improve, you could build a story around Maxine trying to win her first championship. I don't want to see her sniffing the women's world title, but her chasing for the IC title, that's more realistic to me. And I'm just using her as an example for down the road. If she continues to improve, and again, she's a sympathetic character, she's likable, I could see a story like that working. The reason a women's mid-card title wasn't feasible before is because they didn't have a lot of depth in their division. When they split the rosters between Raw and SmackDown, and you had women on Raw, women on SmackDown, maybe you had four or five women on both shows. Maybe. There was not a lot of depth there. There was not a lot of talent there, quite frankly, the way they have now. They had women. That doesn't mean they could all wrestle. And back then, a lot of them were on the show not for the purposes of wrestling, let's be honest. And the women were not a focal point of the show in the way that they are now. So why the hell do you need more than one title, right? Back then, it wouldn't have made sense. But I'm telling you, if they keep adding women at the pace that they are adding them, and they've got some really good women that they have signed, it's not such a crazy idea anymore. WWE announced on Tuesday that one of the voices of ESPN, Joe Tessitore, will be joining the WWE broadcast team later this summer. This was from their statement. One of the most versatile and veteran voices in sports television, Tessitore will join the company as a play-by-play broadcaster beginning this summer. In his role, Tessitore will work alongside analysts Wade Barrett and Corey Graves. Michael Cole and Pat McAfee will remain teamed up. With nearly three decades of broadcasting experience, Tessitore is widely considered one of the industry's foremost play callers. He will remain in his role at ESPN and ABC, where since 2002, he has been a key fixture on the network's coverage of college football. He's called ESPN and ABC Saturday night primetime games, the college football playoff, and more. Tessitore is well known as ESPN's blow-by-blow commentator, having called memorable world championship fights of Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, Terrence Crawford, among others. Additionally, he has led ESPN's Monday Night Football and has called the NFL Pro Bowl and wildcard playoff games on ABC. He has found success in entertainment as well, teaming with Rob Riggle and Stephen Curry on the comedy competition Holy Moly. Note the fact that they said he would be working with Corey Graves and Wade Barrett. They did not say that he was going to be the play-by-play voice on SmackDown or that they would be calling SmackDown together. It is possible they flip the announce teams heading into the Netflix era, and maybe they want the three-man booth on the three-hour show. They said Michael Cole and Pat McAfee are going to stick together. They used to call SmackDown. And so would not at all surprise me to see them back on SmackDown, and you take these three and put them on Raw. Three-man booth on the three-hour show, I mean, that's what I expect Raw to be. I don't think Netflix is spending $5 billion for a three-hour block of programming just to shave it down to two. While I would love that, I'd find that a little hard to believe. I liked the job that Corey Graves did on play-by-play. I thought he adapted to the role very well. The fact that he would still be switched back like he was in Money in the Bank to the color analyst role whenever he and Michael Cole would do those PLEs together probably should have been a sign that it was never meant to be a permanent arrangement. I'm not a big college football guy, but what I have heard of Tessitore, he is very good. He's got that great announcer voice. He's a lifelong WWE fan, which helps that he's got the product knowledge, right, that the play-by-play announcer needs to have for this job. He's led ESPN's WrestleMania coverage each of the past 3 years. He was Nick Khan's first media client during Khan's days as an agent. So this is yet another example of Nick Khan reaching out, reaching into his Rolodex and reaching out to one of his friends in the sports world to bring them in as an announcer. Just because he's great at what he does in the sports world does not necessarily mean it's going to translate well to WWE. I mean, let's be honest here, okay? Let's take a look at what we have had so far. Their batting average with sports announcers has not exactly been great. Mauro Ranallo is doing boxing and MMA, also a big wrestling fan. He was excellent in NXT. Then he got called up to SmackDown, and for various reasons, he did not last very long. Adnan Virk was brought in by Nick Khan to be the lead announcer on Raw because, wouldn't you know it, Nick Khan was his agent before he came to WWE. Sound familiar? He was terrible in the role. He was gone 6 weeks later. So they brought in Jimmy Smith, who was an MMA announcer, to replace him. And he was better, but he also did not last very long. They replaced him as the lead voice on Raw with Kevin Patrick, who had called Major League Soccer games previously. And that's what he's doing again now. He was never a good fit for the role. He lasted less than a year before being moved to SmackDown, and then he was let go. I hope things work out this time. But as you can see, it's been a revolving door. Until we hear him in the role, it's impossible to know if this is going to last or not. Because usually, like with Adnan Virk and Kevin Patrick, and I even said at the time, we've got to give this guy time, right? I remember that first night with Kevin Patrick, and I'm like, all right, it's one night, right? Like, let's see where things are, like, 4 weeks from now, 6 weeks from now. But I think after the first one or two appearances, you hear them in that role and how they interact with their partners, and you have a pretty good sense of whether or not this is going to work or not. So let's wait and see how he sounds in the role, because otherwise it's just impossible to know if this is going to last. We're going to have a pretty good sense after his first couple of shows whether or not this is going to be a long-term thing. This week's episode is sponsored by ExpressVPN. You remember the days before autosave, when you'd be typing up a Word document, and then you would get hit with the dreaded blue screen of death, and you would lose all of your work? Probably not if you were using a Mac. But I remember that. And let me tell you, it was no fun. Hours of podcasts were gone, just because I forgot to hit save. Well, that's what it's like to go online without ExpressVPN. Every time you connect to a network that's not encrypted, it doesn't matter where it is, it could be your grandmother's house. What does she know about Wi-Fi security? If she's got a computer, she barely knows how to turn the damn thing on. Your online data isn't safe, with Granny or anyone else. Any hacker on that network can easily gain access to your most sensitive data. You'd be surprised just how easy it is. Even a 12-year-old could do it. And that data could be worth a lot of money on the dark web. ExpressVPN stops hackers from stealing your data by creating a secure, encrypted tunnel between your device and the internet. What I love about ExpressVPN is how easy it is to use. You just fire up the app, tap one button, and boom, you're connected. And it works on all my devices, so I can carry that protection around with me wherever I go. And it's rated number one by top tech reviewers like CNET and The Verge. When I was on the road in Tampa at the Royal Rumble this year, back in January, I had my laptop with me, and I was glad I had ExpressVPN installed at the Airbnb. My livelihood is on there. I spend a hell of a lot more to fix something on my car than I do for my ExpressVPN subscription. I need my car, so why wouldn't I look at my VPN as something just as important? Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/solomonster. That's expressvpn.com/solomonster, and you can get an extra 3 months free. expressvpn.com/solomonster. Rhea Ripley returned at the end of Raw Monday night, just when it looked like Dominic Mysterio was about to fold like a cheap suit to Liv Morgan, after they won their mixed tag team match against Rey Mysterio and Zelina Vega. So Dom finally got a win over his deadbeat dad. He wound up on top of Liv. It looked like they were about to kiss, and Rhea's music hit, and the reaction was so great. Not only from the fans, but from Liv, too. I thought her reaction was just perfect. She ran for her life after that. Rhea confronted Dom and then refused to listen to him when he tried to explain himself. She's scheduled to open the show tomorrow night, and we'll find out if she's cleared or not based on whether or not we get the challenge to Liv Morgan for a match at SummerSlam. Her star power and just the way that the fans react when she comes out, Rhea Ripley is just on another level right now. And according to PW Insider, internally, she's now listed as a babyface, which, of course, she was always going to be when she came back. That's not a surprise. It's just it's wild how that works, isn't it? Like, Liv Morgan had her arm broken in storyline by Rhea Ripley. That was a way to write her off the show when Liv had shoulder problems. They had Rhea injure her. In the middle of the ring, she pilmanized her arm, if I remember. So Liv Morgan comes back after months on the show. She comes back, and she's talking about her revenge tour, and she ends up being the bad guy in all this. But that's just a testament to how over Rhea Ripley is, and also how horny their male fan base is, and female fan base. You know, judging from the post I see online, I think Rhea has just as many women lusting over her as she has men. I mean, her popularity crosses many demographics. When her and Liv have that first match, though, I don't think Rhea Ripley should win that match. This story is just too good to blow it off after one match. Dominic is going to be involved in some way, officially or unofficially. Maybe it'll be a case of whose corner is he going to be in? Like Elizabeth at WrestleMania 5. Is she going to be in Hogan's corner? Is she going to be in Savage's corner? She ended up in a neutral corner. Maybe that'll be Dominic in this match. I don't think he turns on Rhea. But I do think that they need to find a way for Liv to win, or at least not lose her title yet, and keep it going for a little while longer. Everybody assumes this woman is about to die, but they should make him wait for it. Also on Raw, we had a head-to-head promo in the middle of the ring with Seth Rollins and CM Punk. No Drew McIntyre, because he was suspended after flipping out on Adam Pearce at Money in the Bank after his failed cash-in last weekend. Punk actually asked Pierce on Monday to unsuspend McIntyre so that he could get him in the ring. So Pierce told Punk, look, you stay home tomorrow night. So Punk is not going to be, well, he's not supposed to be on the show. That doesn't mean he won't be there. But he has invited Drew McIntyre to come to the show so they could have a discussion. And what you got out of this segment on Monday is that Seth Rollins does not like CM Punk. Right? Newsflash, I know. What a surprise. He made that very clear, and that also he told him not to get involved in his business, which is what Punk did last weekend. And Punk feigned an apology to him, but he still couldn't bring himself to actually do it without being sarcastic because he's a dick. Actions have consequences, is what CM Punk said to Drew McIntyre before Rollins came out. By the end of that promo, Rollins threw it right back at Punk and warned him, actions have consequences. Sure looks like there may have been something to that little nugget that I shared with all you guys during my SmackDown recap last week before Money in the Bank, when I told you that I had heard that Seth Rollins was penciled in to be the special referee for the CM Punk-Drew McIntyre match at SummerSlam, assuming Punk is cleared in time, which I expect him to be. I'd be very surprised if he wasn't. I suppose it's still possible. And it sounded crazy at the time, but doesn't sound so crazy now, does it? doesn't sound like the plan is for this to be a triple threat match. And if it's not going to be a triple threat match, but Rollins is going to be involved in some way, then being the guest referee or the guest enforcer is the only other thing that would make any sense. So I'd say it sounds pretty likely. That's what we're headed for at SummerSlam. Bron Breakker, he did not win the Intercontinental title of Money in the Bank, but they made it very clear on Monday night that he is still in the hunt when he left Sami Zayn and Ilya Dragunov laying. Now Sami is defending the title on Raw tomorrow night against Dragunov. Gee, I wonder if a certain someone is going to get involved in that match. Looks like we may be heading for a triple threat for the title at SummerSlam. On SmackDown, we had two championship matches all but confirmed for SummerSlam, LA Knight and Logan Paul for the United States title. Logan Paul was not there to sign the contract, but he will be on the show this Friday. The man has been champion. I pointed this out on Friday night. Logan Paul has been the United States champion since November. He has defended the title twice since then. Hell of a champion. A hell of a champion who has now been pinned two straight times in his last two matches. So if you are one of these people assuming that LA Knight, he's got to win the title at SummerSlam, right? Ask yourself this question. Do you honestly believe that they are going to beat Logan Paul three straight times? Because I don't. Now, it's still early yet. I'm not going to make all my SummerSlam predictions right now, but call me crazy. I think he's retaining at SummerSlam. I have a feeling they're going to want to get at least one more match out of these two before he drops it. And Cody Rhodes told Solo Sikoa that he would talk to Nick Aldis and would see him at SummerSlam for the WWE Championship. It's not the SummerSlam main event that I wanted, but it's the SummerSlam main event that we're getting. That's why Solo pinned Cody at Money in the Bank to set this all up. It's why they've been booking Solo as strong as they have lately and doing these big heat segments with the Bloodline, right? Destroying Paul Heyman, destroying Randy Orton. They demolished him on Friday night right in front of Cody, who was tied up in the ropes and helpless to do anything about it. Roman Reigns is coming back. I don't see the point in him coming back before SummerSlam with 3 weeks to go. You save that shit for SummerSlam. Once that happens, Cody can move on, hopefully to Randy, who I would imagine is not going to be very happy that he stuck his neck out for Cody only to get killed for it. And then Roman and Solo, they can start their story. We're going to end up with two warring bloodline groups. We're going to get a War Games match out of it. I could see it all coming. That'll take them through the end of the year. Jacob Fatu, he looked like a wrecking machine on Friday out there. I'm thinking the direction may be Fatu against Kevin Owens, maybe, to avenge what happened to Randy Orton, because the Orton angle felt to me like a way to write him off for SummerSlam. I don't think he's going to have a match on that show, because I don't expect him to be back before then. Yeah, but, you know, depending on how the personal family situation goes with Kevin Owens, you know, his mom was rushed to the hospital last week. She might still be there. I don't know how serious that still is. I don't know how long he may be out for, but let's say they get Kevin Owens back in the next couple of weeks. I just feel like that would be the direction, I assume, for SummerSlam. I don't know. Again, he likes to keep these cards very tight. 5 or 6 matches. Maybe they don't have room for a Jacob Fatu match on that show, but Fatu against Kevin Owens really should be, if they do it, it really should be a SummerSlam match. And real quick on NXT this week, we got a Rascals reunion. Wesley looked like he was about to call it quits when Trey Miguel and Zach Wentz, the former Nash Carter, showed up straight out of TNA. It's part of this whole partnership between NXT and TNA. It seemed pretty clear to me after the Battleground show last month that this was coming. I thought it was going to happen a lot sooner. But it looked even then like, okay, they're teasing a Rascals arrival, a Rascals reunion, and they're going to feud with Gallus. And sure enough, in the back later on Tuesday, they were confronted by Gallus. And now we have a 6-man tag on the show this week. And they brought back Joe Hendry. Say his name and he appears. As Trick Williams' mystery partner, out came Joe Hendry against Ethan Page and Sean Spears. He came off like a bigger star than any of the actual NXT talent in the match. Even got to pin Sean Spears to win the match for his team. And Joe Hendry is one of the six men challenging for the TNA world title at their Slammiversary pay-per-view next weekend with Moose, Nick Nemeth, Frankie Kazarian, Josh Alexander, and Steve Maclin. What do you think the chances are of the countdown buzzer going off at the Royal Rumble and hearing Joe Hendry's theme? I'd say they're pretty damn high if he's still as over in January as he is right now. Let's talk about AEW. I thought Dynamite was a kick-ass show on Wednesday with a lot going on. The Owen Hart tournaments are now done. They are finished. Bryan Danielson finally won a belt. The Owen Hart belt. The pink belt. But now he gets to challenge for the AEW World Championship against Swerve Strickland at All In. Tony Khan really wants Bryan to get that moment at Wembley. I was hoping it would be Hangman. He and Bryan had a hell of a match. Pay-per-view caliber. Restaurant quality, as Jim Ross would say. By the way, I just saw JR underwent surgery on his wrist the other day. Apparently that went well. He didn't say how it happened or why, but I know he's fallen in the past. I hope he didn't fall again. You know, last time he tripped over the cord to his CPAP machine, getting out of bed in the middle of the night and hit his head, I think, on the end table. I mean, there are a lot of older people who die from that. So he got a black eye, and that was about as bad as it was. He's just had a really bad streak of bad luck with his health recently. But anyway, Hangman went to the Young Bucks later on in the show. After Swerve Strickland announced that he would be leading Team AEW in the Blood and Guts match next week. And Hangman told the Elite, "I want in." So he is going to be the fifth man, because that's how he gets his hands on Swerve. 2 weeks after All In, they're coming back with All Out in Chicago. I think that would be a great place for him to challenge Swerve for the title. But then again, I mean, at the rate Tony Khan is throwing pay-per-view quality matches out there on TV, they're liable to turn around and do it on Dynamite in 2 weeks. On the women's side, Mariah May beat Willow Nightingale to win the Owen Hart tournament, and what followed was truly one of the best segments in Dynamite history. It was one of the best closing angles in Dynamite history, and that is no exaggeration. From day one, when Mariah May came to AEW from Stardom, they took the story from the plot of the movie All About Eve. It ties in directly with Toni Storm's timeless gimmick when she started acting like the aging Hollywood starlet. Then she gets befriended by the younger protege who she takes under her wing like her understudy. I even said they should have Mariah substitute for Toni in some of her matches as her understudy. They could have the ring announcer say, "Tonight, playing the role of Toni Storm, Mariah May." Right? Like, really lean into the gimmick. But that was the plan. You know, with the twist being that in the end, it was all part of Mariah's master plan to usurp Toni as the star, or in this case, the champion. So when I say it was a shocking heel turn, I don't mean it like, "Oh my God, I can't believe Mariah turned on Toni." It was the way in which she did it and when they did it that was so shocking. I should have seen it coming, but I wasn't expecting it so soon. As in the same night that she won the tournament and became the number one contender. But there they were, skipping merrily up the aisle, you know, to the Owen Cup trophy. And I thought Toni was laying it on a little thick. I'm like, you know what? This woman just became number one contender for your title. I thought maybe Toni was going to turn on her. But as soon as Mariah grabbed that Owen belt off the stand, the podium on stage, she blasted Toni in the head with it. And the crowd was stunned. I was stunned just by how violent the attack was. Toni did a blade job for it, and Mariah, I mean, we see blood all the time on this show, but not usually with the women, and I can't remember a blade job with the women like this. And Mariah looked like an absolute fucking psycho out there. She's whipping her with the belt, she's striking her in the head repeatedly with Tony's own high heel shoe. The irony being that for over a year now, Toni has been telling people to watch for the shoe. The one person who should have known better than anyone to watch for the shoe got her brains beat in with the shoe. And Mariah didn't look like she was holding back either. Those were some vicious shots that she was laying in. I'm sure Toni told her beforehand, "Hey, don't hold back." And she didn't. She also knocked Luther off the stage, and he took this hilarious bump down through a table. And we had this great visual of Mariah May holding up Toni Storm by her. She's on her knees, and she's just drenched in blood with Mariah standing there behind her, and then they pan out and they have the graphic up for the Wembley match on Screen It All In. You got Mariah rubbing her face in the blood, fans chanting "you sick fuck" at her. This was fantastic. This was just an unbelievable angle here. I only wish they would have saved the blood for the end of the show only and not had Bryan Danielson out there in the opening match bleeding like a fucking pig. I mean, it wasn't even needed there, right? I mean, think about it. Like, Hangman and Bryan, I know it's the finals of the Owen, and Bryan probably wanted to go balls out, and he loves to bleed. That's one of the reasons he came to AEW. No joke. Had this conversation with Vince McMahon. I want to bleed. You can't bleed. But if you think about it, in that match, the story was Bryan's neck. He didn't have to fucking bleed. You know, but it's AEW. Tony's going to let them do whatever the hell they want to do. If Bryan Danielson wants to bleed in the finals of the Owen, you really think Tony is going to say no? He's going to put his foot down? Of course not. Maybe he didn't even tell Tony. He probably just went out there and did it. But this is up there among the greatest betrayals in wrestling that I have ever seen. That closing visual was just done to perfection. They could not have pulled this off any better than they did. That's how you set the stage for your women's world title match on your biggest show of the year. I only hope they didn't peak too early, because there's still 6 weeks to go before Wembley. MJF versus Will Ospreay looked to be the direction for All In, but they threw us a curveball by having MJF throw out the challenge to Ospreay to a match for this Wednesday on Dynamite in Little Rock, Arkansas. I think North Little Rock, Arkansas. And Ospreay said yes. So for the first time ever, we are getting MJF against Will Ospreay for the international title on TV in front of 2,100 people instead of 50,000 in London. Are we sure John Cena is the only one having a retirement tour? Because it feels like Tony Khan is trying to blow through all the big Will Ospreay matches as quickly as he can. They already knocked out Danielson. They knocked out Swerve. Now they're going to knock out the MJF one. He's only been signed since, he's been signed since last year, but he only showed up in February. But it is happening. It's not going to be an angle or a bait and switch. They're advertising it. They're going to open the show with it, I believe. They're giving the match away this week. Reason being, Tony is trying to load up these Dynamites as much as he can because they're in the home stretch when it comes to negotiations with Warner Brothers Discovery for their next media rights deal. We know the numbers have not been great. They have fallen off from where they used to be. Anybody telling you that ratings don't matter anymore is lying to you. Don't listen to those people. They do matter. If they didn't matter, we would not be getting MJF against Will Ospreay and Swerve against Kazuchika Okada on the same show this week. Out of nowhere. Swerve threw out the challenge to Okada, champion against champion. And it's happening this week, since both men are in blood and guts, which, by the way, is for next week's Dynamite. So if you don't think that Tony Khan is not trying to impress Mr. David Zaslav, as he calls him, open your eyes and pay attention. He's got a few hundred million reasons why he wants these shows to do well. What doing well even means for Dynamite anymore, I don't even know. I mean, the show last week pulled in 691,000 viewers. Their demo number was the third lowest of the entire year. I don't know what they would consider a success, and really the only ones who matter here are Warner Brothers Discovery and what they think are a success. That's really all that matters here. If they draw 700,000 viewers and they think that that's a success, then that's what matters. You know, more than, Joe Blow on Twitter. So I don't know what their metric is for success when it comes to these numbers on these shows, but when you load the show up like they are this week, if you can't pull in at least 800,000 viewers, then I don't see how that could be seen as anything but a disappointment. And they haven't touched 800K since they put CM Punk back on TV to pop a number back in April. So that doesn't seem very likely. Anybody thinking that, oh, it's a given, they're going to do 800,000 or 900,000 this week, I think you're in for a rude awakening, is what I think. And Pac won a four-way match later in the show to earn the right to challenge for the international title at Wembley Stadium, so he could get his Wembley moment, he says. Well, if that's the case, and he's getting that title shot at Wembley, MJF is not walking into Wembley then as the international champion, which could mean a Daniel Garcia return on Wednesday to cost MJF his match which would then give us MJF against Daniel Garcia at All In, with Will Ospreay defending the international title against Pac. Now that would be a hell of a match. MJF against Garcia? They've got a hell of a task in front of them to convince me that that is the best match for MJF on that show. It'd be a hell of a spot for Daniel Garcia, but that would put MJF at best fourth from the top at All In, behind the world title match, behind Ospreay and Pac, and behind Tony Storm and Mariah May. Maybe even Mercedes against Britt Baker, but at least MJF and Garcia, they have a big angle behind it. Mercedes and Britt, they really don't, right? Britt just showed up and asked for a match. Let's take some mailbag questions. You can always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Josh from Blaine, Minnesota. Been listening since 2017. I wanted your opinion about possible matches for Brock Lesnar if and when he returns, mainly NXT names or newer guys that debuted on the main roster, and was wondering which of these five stars you would like to see him in the ring with the most. Ilya Dragunov, Bron Breakker, Trick Williams, Oba Femi, or Jacob Fatu? Well, the names that jump out at me right away are Ilya Dragunov, Bron Breakker, and Jacob Fatu. So I think if Brock were to come back, I'd love to see him wrestle some or all of those guys. Oba Femi, I mean, I don't see that happening anytime in the near future. I think he's still got some time in NXT. That would be another one. Honestly, all of them except Trick. I don't see Trick against Brock. That one doesn't jump out at me as like, man, I can't wait to see Trick Williams against Brock Lesnar. I want to see Brock in there with some of these guys that, you know, they hit hard or they can match him size-wise. Like, the one of all of these five, if I had to settle on one, would be Jacob Fatu. I think Jacob Fatu and Brock Lesnar would be just a battle of the two freak athletes. But, I mean, they're all freaks in their own way. Like, Bron Breakker's a fucking freak. But I just think Lesnar and Jacob Fatu would be a lot of fun. Carlos from Bayshore, New York. I was listening to you and JD on Tuesday. Love the show, by the way. Thank you very much. And when you guys were talking about John Cena's potential WrestleMania opponent, it got me thinking of the potential WrestleMania 41 card. I am personally in favor of having Cena's chase for 17 happen at Mania and agree that he should face and lose to Gunther, with The Rock most likely having a match on that show against either Roman or Cody. And he says, my dream card has Rock, Roman, and Drew Cody. He thinks Drew should get a title run. Can't see that happening with Gunther on Raw. Should Cena's final WrestleMania match be a night one or night two main event? Night one. It would be night one. The Rock gave Cody his moment on night two this year. He was very generous. If he wrestles again next year, he's not wrestling night one again. He's getting night two. So it almost doesn't even matter who The Rock's opponent is. If it's Cody, if it's Roman, you could pencil that in right now. That's going to be your night two main event. So if anything, Cena would have to settle for night one. Roderick from Baltimore, Maryland. While Finn Balor has no doubt had a successful run in WWE, it still feels underwhelming. I feel like it traces all the way back to 2016 when he became the first Universal Champion, only to surrender it the very next night due to injury. It never felt like he fully regained the momentum he had during that summer when he was a top pick for Raw and beat Roman Reigns and Seth Rollins on his way to the title. Had Balor not gotten hurt and was able to have that run as Universal Champion, do you see his WWE run going any differently? Do you think Balor would have been a bigger player in the company, or would he have ended up where he is now as a solid role player and contender who was not quite viewed as the guy? Finn Balor was never going to be the guy. So we could just dismiss that right now. Not under Vince McMahon. He was never going to be the guy. And I think ultimately he would have settled into the role that he's basically in right now. You're asking me if I think that that injury that derailed that title run in 2016 would have an impact on where he is right now in 2024. And I'm going to say no. I think ultimately he would have ended up more or less in the same place that he's in now. It definitely derailed his momentum. I definitely think he could have had more time on top. Would he still be a top player in this company, though, beyond that period? No, I don't think so. It's like Kevin Owens having the Universal title, right? He was the Universal champion, and he had a run with it, and then Goldberg beat him for it, and he hasn't held a world title since, or a title of the universe, I guess you would say. Man, fuck that Universal title. I'm glad they don't acknowledge it anymore. But Owens has been in the mix, right? Owens has been a reliable role player for them in whatever they need him for, whether it's an upper mid-card feud. He was the Intercontinental Champion a bunch of times. I think the U.S. Champion as well. Of late, he's been involved in the Bloodline stuff. He's been in a pretty prominent position. He was literally just in the main event of Money in the Bank last weekend. And that's kind of the role that Balor is in. You know, he would have had his run as Universal Champion, and I think he would have settled into the same type of role. But he was never going to be the guy. He just wasn't going to be. Not when this company had other people like Roman Reigns and Cody Rhodes, or John Cena was still kind of around at the time. It was never going to be Balor. Marlon from Dallas, Texas, by way of Memphis, Tennessee. Although we are not getting Swerve against Hangman at Wembley, I feel like that match is not going to be a clean finish. And what I mean by that is I got a feeling a jealous Hangman is going to show up and try and cost Swerve the title out of pure rage and jealousy. And at the same time, I think Nigel McGuinness will make his move and attack Danielson and set up their match for the next pay-per-view. What do you think of this idea? I know it sounds overbooked, but I don't know about a clean win over either of the guys at Wembley. I think they need to tread very carefully, because you don't want to have your main event at Wembley Stadium derailed by a bunch of overbooking and interference. And that's not the way Tony Khan usually books these shows. I think Bryan Danielson going to the main event at All In, it's either going to be Danielson with a hard-fought win or Danielson with a hard-fought loss. I don't see Hangman getting involved in that. Now, you say that you have Nigel McGuinness making his move and attacking Danielson to set up their match at the next event, which would be All Out. I think that's a complete waste. You've had a year to build to Nigel McGuinness if he was ever going to come out of retirement. This is the time and place to do it. Think about it. Nigel, okay, you got Wembley Stadium coming up, and you're going to shoot an angle on that show with him to set up his return match, his first match in like a decade, 2 weeks later in Chicago. What sense does that make? You either do the match at Wembley or you don't. And Nigel doesn't have to come out of retirement, and he could just be an announcer and do his magic shows that he does every now and then. But if ever he was going to come out of retirement for a match, it would be at Wembley against Bryan Danielson. They opted not to do that. Whether that was a Tony Khan call or a Nigel McGuinness call. Maybe he doesn't want to come out of retirement. But to me, if you were going to do the match but do it 2 weeks later in Chicago, I mean, what the fuck would be the point? It's like what I said going into Forbidden Door, where it's like you can't put the world title on Will Ospreay for a bunch of different reasons. But why the hell are you going to put the world title on Will Ospreay in New York on Long Island 2 months before you have this huge stadium show in London? If anything, you would belt him there. You don't do it 2 months beforehand in New York. It would be just completely ridiculous. That's how I look at this. I think it would be ridiculous to do the Nigel McGuinness match anywhere but Wembley Stadium. Dak from St. Paul, Minnesota. It seems like outside of the big four shows, WWE PLEs look to be about five matches only. What do you think of WWE returning to the brand-specific PLEs? It would allow more talent to be on the shows and be able to add some variety. Obviously, the big four and Saudi shows would be co-branded, but why not have the others be brand-specific? And I more so mean it like it was with the OG split, where it was every other month, not two brand-specific PLEs in the same month like in 2016. What do you think? Yeah, that was just a terrible fucking idea, and we don't ever have to go back to that. The two brand-specific PLEs in the same month. My issue with a lot of those OG brand-specific shows was that they weren't worthy of $50. They weren't worthy of the price tag. You know, now you can get them for $12 with a Peacock subscription. I still don't see the point in doing them if you're going to switch off, because most of these shows, I just don't think it works because of their schedule. Most of these shows are going to be co-branded. You need talent from Raw and SmackDown. So let's game this out. You have the Royal Rumble, right? January, February, you have the Royal Rumble. You're going to have talent from both shows. The Elimination Chamber, you're going to have talent from both shows. WrestleMania, you're going to have talent from both shows. Money in the Bank, you're going to have talent from both shows. Two Saudi shows throughout the year, you're going to have talent from both shows. SummerSlam, you're going to have talent from both shows. Survivor Series, you're going to have talent from both shows. That's eight shows right there that need to be co-branded. So are you going to have one Raw exclusive show in March and then not have another one, not have a SmackDown exclusive one until what? June? September? It just doesn't work. I just don't see the point in doing that. You know, you didn't have Elimination Chamber and Money in the Bank, I don't think, when they started doing the like the OG days of doing the brand-specific shows, right? Because they didn't start with the gimmick pay-per-views really until, what was it, like 09, I think, right? I'm pretty sure they were doing the brand-specific shows before that. So back then, you didn't have Elimination Chamber. You didn't have Money in the Bank, which have to be co-branded. It just doesn't work. I don't like that. Michael, I just watched the last pay-per-view CM Punk was part of before leaving WWE and forgot how the crowd really didn't like the Royal Rumble match. I don't remember. Did you like the event, or did you feel like the John Cena-Randy Orton match was boring? I thought the match was okay. Bryan should have at least been in the Rumble, and Punk could have won the thing. Also, I found it funny that the first two entrants in the Rumble match were Seth Rollins and CM Punk, the possible main event for Night 1 of WrestleMania. The Cena-Orton match, boy, you're taking me back now to the dark days. The Cena-Orton match in 2014, it wasn't awful. It just wasn't really any good. I had just seen them work the same match, I think more or less, at the Madison Square Garden house show a few weeks before this. But the crowd shat all over it and they chanted Daniel Bryan. They crapped all over that match. Punk should not have won the Rumble. Bryan should have won the Rumble, but they were too stubborn to realize it. You know, them bringing back Batista to win the Royal Rumble and challenge Randy Orton at WrestleMania in the middle of the rise of Daniel Bryan was just as tone-deaf as what The Rock did this year. Every bit as tone-deaf as The Rock coming back in the middle of Cody's story to challenge Roman Reigns at WrestleMania. And both times they at least changed plans and did the right thing. The 2015 Royal Rumble was even worse. Rumble match was even worse. Like, it's one thing to fuck up the Rumble one time. To fuck it up two consecutive years takes a special kind of talent. Mark from Florida. I've always wanted to know your thoughts on Takeshi Morishima. Any memories of him from Ring of Honor or matches of his that you would recommend? Do you think that we will ever get a Dark Side of the Ring featuring his story? Yeah, you know, Morishima is one of the sadder what-if stories in wrestling for me. He was a super athletic big man from Japan. Made his bones in pro wrestling Noah. When he first showed up in the States, he was unstoppable. You know, he was this monster. And he had a memorable run as the Ring of Honor World Champion. He came in not long after I first got into Ring of Honor. I started attending shows in 2006. He came in 2007. So I got to see a lot of those matches in person. And the two that I would recommend most are his battles with Bryan Danielson. The first one where Bryan suffered a detached retina and somehow kept wrestling for another 15 minutes. I don't know how. The man almost lost his eye. Then we got eye patch Bryan for a while. I wasn't the least bit surprised that he and Brock Lesnar had such a great match at Survivor Series. Anybody who saw those Danielson-Morishima matches knew how well that dynamic would work. The whole, you know, David and Goliath thing. But also their last match at Final Battle in 2008. Was their best one. I was at that one. I think that may have been the last match that Morishima ever wrestled in the U.S. I know it was his last match in Ring of Honor. I'll never forget. You know, the first time I ever saw Morishima live, It was at the Manhattan Center. And right on the corner, they've got a place called the TikTok Diner. You know, you look over and there's Madison Square Garden basically across the street, like it's in the shadows. But we would always stop there to grab food, either before the show or after the show was over. And that night after the show, my brother and I, we walk in and we sit down and I see this giant man sitting in a booth, like halfway across the diner, got his back turned. And he's sitting in this booth that had to be far too small for him. But I said, man, that's Morishima. And I had to walk by his table to go to the bathroom. I wasn't going to bother him or anything, but I look over and I wish I could remember what he was eating. But he had like two full plates of food. I just remember thinking to myself, wow, like big boy's eating well tonight. He was a special talent. You know, WWE actually just released his two tryout matches from 2008 on their new Vault channel on YouTube. Funny enough, he wrestled Charlie Haas in one and then Jamie Noble in the other. I don't know if that's why you decided to send this question in this week or if that was just a coincidence. But if you haven't seen those two tryout matches, you can go watch them. Of course, they sent him to the ring to the fucking Orient Express theme song, because of course they did. But after that ROH run, he went back to Japan full time and his career just fell off. Not right away, but, you know, it was several years later he retired. He was only 37 when he called it quits. I looked up his birthday. He was only 37 when he called it quits. He claimed at the time it was due to being diagnosed with diabetes. That's not why he retired. And I think he admitted that later on. That wasn't the actual reason. That was the cover reason. He just ended up in a really bad place. And he ended up, I think, depressed and broke and homeless for a while. He got in trouble with the law. I know he assaulted a cab driver once. He broke both his cheekbones. He had no money. And he figured that he could just get somebody else to pay his fare. So he got in the cab. He rode around for a while. And after a while, the driver was like, hey, you know, he wants to be paid. And Morishima beat him up. He lost a ton of weight. Any photos I've seen of him from like the last, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, maybe 10 years, he lost so much weight. Like he almost looks unrecognizable. It's just really sad how it all turned out for him. It honestly sounds like he has some serious mental health issues that need to be addressed. I hope he is getting them addressed. There's been no news about him in the last several years. I tried to find something and I mean, I assume he's alive or else we would have heard otherwise, but whatever he's doing, it's been very quiet. I hope he's got his life together somewhat. I think he would make a good choice for a Dark Side of the Ring episode, especially, look, they've done episodes on, you know, less well-known people in wrestling. At least here, he's worked against people who are well-known on TV now, like Kevin Owens and Bryan Danielson and Nigel McGuinness. They couldn't get Owens for it, but maybe they could get some of the AEW folks, you know, that worked with him to go on camera and talk about him. Clark from Medicine Hat, Alberta, Canada. I remember you saying that you disliked the WWF so much in 1995 to the point that you nearly gave up on being a fan. Which leads me to asking you this. What do you think was the worst year for WWE of the two? 1995? Or 2009. For me, it was 2009 because that's when they started having those stupid celebrity guest hosts, when the PG era was in full effect, the beginning of those stupid gimmick pay-per-views, and DX's failed final run. It's reasons like that why I gave up on WWE the following year because of how terrible 2009 was. In 95, at least, Owen Hart and Yokozuna were the best tag team that year. Well, I mean, that says it all, doesn't it? When Owen and Yokozuna are the best tag team in the entire company, that's not exactly a great endorsement of the tag team division or a great argument to make in favor of that year. I'm just saying. Bret Hart continued to have great matches against guys like Hakushi, Jean-Pierre Lafitte, Diesel and the Bulldog, as well as his no-holds-barred match with Owen on Raw, which I think is the most underrated no-holds-barred match ever. So what you're saying is that Bret was the only shining light that year. I'm glad you said it. If I said it, people would roll their eyes. I'm glad you said it, not me. He says Razor Ramon and Shawn Michaels had another classic ladder match. In Your House started out that year, which eventually paved the way for them to create their future B pay-per-view names in the Attitude Era. 1995 to me was just a bump in the road for the WWF. I'm not really sure why you would cite In Your House starting and then using some of the pay-per-view titles for Attitude Era shows. I'm not sure how that makes that a better year, but okay. Yes, look, 95 was a bump in the road year, but it was still dreadful. Doesn't make it any less horrific than it was in a lot of different ways. You mentioned, for example, PG being in full effect in 2009. If that was PG, then 95 was TVY7. Okay, 95 was the year where Vince McMahon dropped acid for the first time. And we ended up with a garbage man, a plumber, an evil dentist, a hog farmer, Aldo Montoya with a jock strap on his face, Santa Claus, Mantar, half man, half tar, and what was the other one I was going to mention? Oh, Fatu. That's right. Fatu, the man who could make a difference. What difference did he make? Do I go take a piss right before or during his match? Because he was always at the bottom of the card. Company was ice cold. We had Bret Hart feuding with a pirate over a leather jacket. We had a year of Diesel as champion. That alone is enough to send a shiver up my spine. The Wayland Mercy gimmick, that could have been something cool, but Spivey was washed by that point. We had one of the worst King of the Ring tournaments ever that year. Gave us King Mabel. It gave us King Mabel and Diesel in the main event at SummerSlam. For all you people bitching and moaning about Solo Sikoa against Cody Rhodes and how it doesn't feel like a SummerSlam main event, you haven't felt pain until you've watched Diesel and Mabel lumbering around the ring. I don't want to hear it. Then we got one of the worst pay-per-views that I have ever seen. That October In Your House from Winnipeg with Diesel and Bulldog in the main event, a match so horrible that Vince McMahon literally threw down his headset in disgust when the show was over and stormed to the back. But we got some gems. I don't want to make it sound like it was a completely irredeemable year. We had some gems that year. We had mainly from Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. As awful as that year was, imagine how much worse it would have been without Bret and Shawn. Bret actually had one of the worst WrestleMania matches of his life that year with Bob Backlund. But he had great matches with the British Bulldog, where Bret bled a gusher. That was the In Your House match in Hershey at the end of the year. Hakushi, and you mentioned Jean-Pierre Lafitte. That Bulldog match, by the way, I have to say it, that Bulldog match was even better than their Wembley Stadium match. He gave Kevin Nash one of the best matches of his life at Survivor Series. That Diesel heel turn was great. It was about 9 months too late, but it was great. Michaels against Jeff Jarrett in Nashville for the Intercontinental title. The Shawn Razor ladder match at SummerSlam was the only saving grace on that entire show. 1995 was worse. There was a lot that I did not like about 2009 also. Really, I'll be honest with you, a lot of those early years after I started doing the sound off, like I look back on those years now, like 09 and 2010, and they weren't great. They really weren't, and a lot of them blend together for me. They don't really stand out. Now, as I recall, though, about 2009, SmackDown was not bad. It was mostly Raw that was crap, especially with all the guest host stuff. For every Bob Barker or Jesse Ventura, there were half a dozen terrible ones. The DX reunions, they all sucked. Every single one of them sucked. I never liked them. I didn't like it in 2006. I didn't like it in 2009. They were just watered-down versions of what DX used to be. Like the first two iterations of DX, the original, and then when Triple H took over in 98, they brought in X-Pac and the Outlaws, like that was DX at its best. Everything that followed, like again, from 06 on, all those reunions and the glow sticks and everything, it was just to sell merch. That was it. They had the one segment where they distorted Vince McMahon's voice and everybody laughed at him. That was kind of funny. But, you know, outside of that, I can't think of a single moment from those last two DX runs that I remember fondly or really give a shit about. But 2009 gave us one of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time with Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. The CM Punk Jeff Hardy stuff was really good. That was on SmackDown. The Jericho Mysterio stuff was really good. So it was a stronger year than 95. I can safely say that. Neil from Chicago. If Bret Hart versus Goldberg never happened, when do you think Bret would have retired from the ring? I think Bret was 42 or 43 when he retired. If he had stayed healthy, he could have kept wrestling into his late 40s easily, maybe 50-ish. That would have taken him well into the Ruthless Aggression era in WWE, because I have no doubt he would have ended up back wrestling for Vince. If not right after WCW died, then within a few years, like all those other guys, Goldberg and Hogan and Steiner, they sat home and collected their money. It may have taken a few years, but he would have ended up there, and we would have gotten one more Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels match, probably at WrestleMania. Bret Hart against Randy Orton, Bret Hart against John Cena, Bret Hart against Kurt Angle. That's the big one for me. Probably would have gotten a Chris Benoit match in WWE with him, Jericho. Like, we would have gotten all of that. He would have worked with all those key guys. That's what we missed out on. Dallas from Minnesota. If for whatever reason, Ric Flair leaves Jim Crockett Promotions / NWA and forms the Four Horsemen in the WWF, who could you see in this hypothetical Four Horsemen? You know, the Four Horsemen, it would not have worked as well in WWE. I can't say it wouldn't have worked at all. I don't think it would have worked, but I can't say it would not have worked at all. It really was not a faction that would have fit well with WWF at that time. It really worked a lot better in the NWA. But Flair and Ted DiBiase, they were very good friends. I think DiBiase, not doing the cartoony Million Dollar Man gimmick, though. That's the thing. Like, the Mr. Perfect and the Million Dollar Man. Like, I don't think that a horseman faction, if they're doing those cartoonish gimmicks, works. It would have to be DiBiase. It would have to be Kurt Hennig. Like, those guys would have made great horsemen back then. I think someone like Paul Orndorff could have been interesting as a choice. He could have been the power of the group. It depends on the timeline here. We're talking mid-80s, late-80s. I think Bobby Heenan could have been in the role of J.J. Dillon. If you're talking late-80s, Arn and Tully, they were already there working as the Brainbusters. So Flair could have reformed the Horsemen with most of the key players and then just add one more guy in like Hennig or maybe Rick Rude. You know, and again, put Bobby with them and there you go. You got a WWE version of the Four Horsemen. But I just don't think it would have worked for more than maybe a year. I mean, Vince would have fed them to Hogan, and I think that would have been the end of it. Plus, he marketed the product to kids, so many of those Flair promos and those Horsemen promos would have been neutered. It just wouldn't have been the same. And David, from Newark, New Jersey, what are your five favorite black and gold NXT TakeOver specials and your five favorite black and gold NXT TakeOver matches? Oh, I don't know about the specials. I have no idea. But I'll give you my five favorite black and white, or black and white, black and gold, black and gold era TakeOver matches. I'll give that to you. And this is not in any particular order. I'm just spitting them out here. Sasha Banks and Bayley, first Brooklyn TakeOver, is on the list. Johnny Gargano against Andrade. This is when he was still Andrade Cien Almas. TakeOver Philadelphia. Those are the two greatest NXT matches that I have ever seen. DIY against The Revival at the Toronto TakeOver, the first one. One of the greatest tag team matches I've ever seen. Johnny Gargano against Adam Cole at the TakeOver in New York. That was right before WrestleMania. That was their 2 out of 3 falls match. And Shinsuke Nakamura's debut against Sami Zayn at TakeOver Dallas. I was fortunate enough to be in the building for 3 of those 5, and the atmosphere was just incredible. Black and gold NXT was just something else. It was something very special. So thank you guys for the questions. I appreciate it. There were a bunch of others that I was not able to get to, but I'm still trying to comb through it all, and we'll save some for next week. So get any new questions you might have on into me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. I wanted to rely on them a little bit more this week, because again, I'm under the weather here. So I figured let's try to get a mailbag in here, even though the show I know wasn't as long as it usually is. But I'm fucking dying here. So I'm glad we got through that. And thank you for tuning into the show this week. I will be back with you next Sunday, as I am every weekend, for another Sound Off. That'll be episode 871. And live on YouTube this week, coming up after Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. Dynamite in particular is a loaded show. 250th episode, MJF and Will Ospreay for the first time ever. We'll talk about that during the week. Of course, I'll be live on Tuesday night with JD on his channel for Tuesday Night Titans, which continues to kick ass. So thank you for the support there. And we'll do it all over again next Sunday. So until then, be well, stay safe. Have yourselves a great week, and I will see you for more Sound Off, episode 871. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monsters Sounds Off.
So if you're not hacked, hop on X. All these wrestlers getting hacked. You know, I used to make fun of the wrestlers who would post something really fucking stupid, and then they would be like, oh, I got hacked. It's like, no, you didn't. But now they really are. Now they really are getting hacked. Well, what is their password? Like Hulk Hogan, for example. What is his password? Brother? Lex Luger, what's your password? Total package? Maybe it's a wrestler thing. Kevin says I would laugh my ass off if that isn't Hogan's password. I'm telling you, I guarantee you, Hogan's password was either brother, dude, or Jack. And then he got fucking hacked. Change your password.
The Sala Monster Sounds Off. Each week, bursting with content. Podcasts, predictions, reviews, YouTube live streams, and more. Become a channel member for perks and follow the Sala Monster on Twitter at Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster Sounds Off.